there's so much that's in the text. And so often we read the text, you know, a time or two, and we think, oh, you know, I know what this is about. I think I've got an idea of what this is about. And there's so much more that is there. As a way of getting us started here, Dad, I'd just like to read you a story. And I think maybe this story will help us get into what we're going to do. I want to read the story. I want to talk about some of the things that we can look for when we are doing observations on a text. And then we're going to do a little practice with a biblical text and work on that a little bit on your own and then some together as well. But first I want to read you this story. It'll take me about, you know, 5 or 6 minutes to read this story, so you can just relax for a few minutes. The name of this is The Student, the Fish, and Agassiz, and it's written by the student. This is a true story. It was more than 15 years ago that I entered the laboratory of Professor Agassiz and told him I had enrolled my name in the scientific school as a student of natural history. He asked me a few questions about my object in coming, my antecedents generally, the mode in which I afterwards proposed to use the knowledge I might acquire, and finally, whether I wished to study any special branch. To the latter, I replied that while I wished to be well-grounded in all departments of zoology, I purposed to devote myself specially to insects. "When do you wish to begin?" he asked. "Now," I replied. This seemed to please him, and with an energetic, "very well," he reached from a shelf a huge jar of specimens in yellow alcohol. "Take this fish," said he, "and look at it. We call it a hemulon. By and by, I will ask what you've seen." With that, he left me, but in a moment returned with explicit instructions as to the care of the object entrusted to me. "No man is fit to be a naturalist," said he, "who does not know how to take care of specimens." I was to keep the fish before me in a tin tray and occasionally moisten the surface with alcohol from the jar, always taking care to replace the stopper tightly. Those were not the days of ground glass stoppers and elegantly shaped exhibition jars. All the old students will recall the huge necklace glass bottles with their leaky, wax-besmeared corks, half-eaten by insects and begrimed with cellar dust. Entomology was a cleaner science than ichthyology, but the example of the professor who had unhesitatingly plunged to the bottom of the jar to produce the fish was infectious. And though this alcohol had, quote, a very ancient and fish-like smell, I really dared not show any aversion within these sacred precincts, and treated the alcohol as though it were pure water. Still, I was conscious of a passing feeling of disappointment, for gazing at a fish did not commend itself to an ardent entomologist. My friends at home, too, were annoyed when they discovered that no amount of cologne would drown the perfume that haunted me like a shadow. In 10 minutes, I had seen all that could be seen in that fish and started in search of the professor, who had, however, left the museum. And when I returned, after lingering over some of the odd animals stored in the upper apartment, my specimen was dry all over. I dashed the fluid over the fish as if to resuscitate it from a fainting fit and looked with anxiety for a return of the normal sloppy appearance. This little excitement over, nothing was to be done but return to a steadfast gaze at my mute companion. Half an hour passed. An hour. Another hour. The fish began to look loathsome. I turned it over and around, looked it in the face. Ghastly. From behind, beneath, above, sideways, at a three-quarters view. Just as ghastly. I was in despair. At an early hour, I concluded that lunch was necessary, so with infinite relief, the fish was carefully replaced in the jar, and for an hour, I was free. On my return, I learned that Professor Agassiz had been at the museum, but had gone and would not return for several hours. My fellow students were too busy to be disturbed by continued conversation. Slowly, I drew forth that hideous fish, and with a feeling of desperation, again looked at it. I might not use a magnifying glass. Instruments of all kinds were forbidden. My two hands, my two eyes, and the fish. It seemed a most limited field. I pushed my finger down its throat to feel how sharp its teeth were. I began to count the scales in the different rows until I was convinced that that was nonsense. At last, a happy thought struck me. I would draw the fish. And now, with surprise, I began to discover new features in the creature. Just then, the professor returned. "That is right," said he. "A pencil is one of the best of eyes. I'm glad to notice, too, that you keep your specimen wet and your bottle corked." With these encouraging words, he added, "Well, what is it like?" He listened attentively to my brief rehearsal of the structure of parts whose names were still unknown to me, the fringed gill arches and movable operculum, the pores of the head, fleshy lips and lidless eyes, the lateral eye and the spinous fin and forked tail, the compressed and arched body. When I had finished, he waited as if expecting more, and then with an air of disappointment, "You have not looked very carefully." "Why," he continued more earnestly, "you haven't seen one of the most conspicuous features of the animal, which is as plainly before your eyes as the fish itself. Look again, look again." And he left me to my misery. I was piqued. I was mortified. Still more of that wretched fish? But now I set myself to my task with a will and discovered one new thing after another until I saw how just the professor's criticism had been. The afternoon passed quickly, and when towards its close the professor inquired, "Do you see it yet?" "No," I replied. "I am certain I do not. But I see how little I saw before." "That is next best," said he earnestly. "But I won't hear you now. Put away your fish and go home. Perhaps you'll be ready with a better answer in the morning. I will examine you before you look at your fish." This was disconcerting. Not only must I think of my fish all night, studying without the object before me what this unknown but most visible feature might be, but also, without reviewing my new discoveries, I must give an exact account of them the next day. I had a bad memory. So I walked home by Charles River in a distracted state with my two perplexities. The cordial greeting from the professor the next morning was reassuring. Here was a man who seemed to be quite as anxious as I that I should see for myself what he saw. "Do you perhaps mean," I asked, "that the fish has symmetrical sides with paired organs?" His thoroughly pleased, "Of course, of course," repaid the wakeful hours of the previous night. After he had discoursed most happily and enthusiastically, as he always did, upon the importance of this point, I ventured to ask what I should do next. "Oh, look at your fish," he said, and left me again to my own devices. In a little more than an hour, he returned and heard my new catalog. "That is good, that is good," he repeated, "but that is not all. Go on." And so, for 3 long days, he placed that fish before my eyes, forbidding me to look at anything else or to use any artificial aid. "Look, look, look," was his repeated injunction. This was the best entomological lesson I ever had, a lesson whose influence has extended to the details of every subsequent study, a legacy the professor has left to me, as he has left it to many others, of inestimable value, which we could not buy, with which we cannot part. I love that story. And I hope you see the significance of that for what we're trying to do today. Basically, this is your fish for today. We won't have 3 long days to study it, but I hope to give you a taste of doing some firsthand examination and trying to make some firsthand observations. What I'd like to do, first of all, this other sheet here that has things to observe, I know that's kind of a scary looking sheet with that long list of things. We're not going to talk about all of these today, but I did think that I would try to go over maybe 9 or 10 of these things here at the top. If we can just have some familiarity with those things, we'll be able to do a lot, because those are the most important things that are listed right there at the top. And then I'm going to, after I've spent a few minutes talking about these, I'm going to let you loose to try to make some observations on this text of Psalm 1. And so our approach today is really a workshop kind of approach. And if you remember the line there in the story that says, a pencil is one of the best of eyes, that's one of the principles that we're going to be trying to apply here today. This is a method that I call an observation worksheet method. Some of you may have been exposed to this sort of thing before. InterVarsity has like a manuscript study that uses this sort of method. Have any of y'all ever been in a precept upon precept Bible study? Also uses a very similar method to what we're talking about. In fact, my first introduction to this kind of method was 25 years ago when I was in college and first got involved with a precept Bible study. So let me just talk through some of these categories at the outset. And the first one there that's mentioned is repetition of words. Let me just write these up here. One of the first things that I like to look for when I'm doing an observation worksheet is, are there some words in the passage that are used repeatedly? Because if there are terms that appear there with some frequency, then that's a good sense that this is an important idea for this passage. So, for example, if you have the word righteousness that appears four times in three verses, then that's a good hint that that's an important idea for this particular text. And the way that, and we'll illustrate this here as we go on, but the way that I like to mark repeating words is just pick a color. So, you know, pick your red crayon and, you know, draw a red circle around every appearance of righteousness, and then pick another color and go on and draw a circle around other repeating words. I try to use the same marking for the same identical word. If there's another word that has a similar kind of conception or so forth, then I might try to do something similar, but I try to save the red circle for the repetition of the exact same word. Contrast is another thing that we can look for. And the key here is, if you see the word but, that's a big clue that you have a contrast. And let's mark that with a lightning bolt kind of symbol. Now, you don't have to have the word but in order to have a contrast. For example, you could have light and darkness mentioned in the same text, and that would be a contrast that you might make note of over in your margin. And there might not be the word but there, but there's still a contrast that is there. The third thing that's mentioned there on your sheet is comparisons. And the words that you're looking for when you look for comparisons are the words as or like. And so the way that I like to mark this is I draw a circle around as or like. So for example, if we said something like this, Bill is like a tree. Well, there's like, so I'm going to circle like, and then I'm going to draw an arrow to the topic. What's being talked about here in this sentence? That's our topic. What's being talked about here? Bill is what we're talking about, yeah. So I draw an arrow to Bill, and then I'll draw another arrow to the illustration. So whenever we have a comparison, we're going to have a topic, we're going to have an illustration, and then we're also going to have a point of similarity, which a lot of times in the Bible, the point of similarity is left unspoken. And so that's the tricky one. We have to figure out, well, what is the point of similarity? How is Bill like a tree? And maybe Bill is like a tree because he's tall. So he's got similarity to a tree in terms of his height. When Jesus talks about Herod as a fox, he says, Herod, that fox. Well, that doesn't use the word like or as, but that's also a comparison. It's a we call it a metaphor if we're going back to our high school English grammar. Pardon me?
If he was like a fox, he would be sly.
Yes, and that's the question. How is Herod like a fox? And we have to be careful because the point of similarity might be different for a first century world than it is for us. It's true, we tend to think about foxes as clever or sly. That's the attribute that we associate with foxes. But animals around the world are associated with all kinds of different qualities. For example, we think of snakes as being associated with evil, but in some other cultures, they're associated with good. And so we have to make sure that we have the right sort of association. So there we have to do kind of a historical cultural background analysis to get a little information about how did the ancient Greeks and Romans and or first century people think about fox. In that time, the fox is probably associated with viciousness. So that's probably what Jesus is saying about Herod there, that Herod is like a fox because he's vicious, like a fox is vicious. So that's a comparison. Another thing that we can look for is list. We might be looking at the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians where it says the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience. If we had this list, then I would mark this by there's number one in the list, there's number two in the list, there's number three in the list. And this would be an example of a simple list, just a bang, 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 bang. We could have an example of a more complex list where we see a series of things that maybe happen over the course of a paragraph or longer. But we'll just stick with observing simple lists for today. Another thing that we can see is cause and effect. It may be that something within the text is seen as being a cause for something that results from that. And so I mark this like a C. Say verse 1 has got a cause in verse 1. And that moves to an effect that's described in verses 2 or 3. That's a way that we can mark that. Another thing is figures of speech. And I might mark that by just writing an FOS above it to mark it as a figure of speech. What a figure of speech is something that is used that's not speaking in literal terms. For example, when Jesus calls Herod a fox, he is not saying that Herod is a little furry animal, you know, with brown colored fur. He's using a figure of speech. He's not literally calling Herod a fox. So we understand that the Bible is not just the Word of God, but it's great literature, and it makes heavy use of literary devices. And God has inspired this kind of figurative language to be there in the Bible, and so we need to try to understand it. A lot of different conjunctions. We'll just try to name some of the more important ones. We can also have conjunctions that show condition or concession. And maybe this is kind of a subcategory of the logical conjunctions, but words like if, dot, 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 then, or just if by itself, or although. These would be some examples of conjunctions. Now, why are conjunctions important? Conjunctions are important because they help us to see how the pieces of the text fit together. So that can help us to understand the structure of the passage as a whole. Understanding the structure of a text might sound tedious and boring, but a lot of times understanding the structure of a text really illumines what the overarching meaning of the text is. So identifying these conjunctions can help with that. What I might do is just take a red ink pen or something like that and go through and circle every conjunction. Usually I skip over and because that appears so frequently that it can kind of obscure some of the other conjunctions that are more important. But the and can be important at times as well. But I'll go through and maybe put a rectangle in red ink around the conjunctions, and that helps me to see how this thing is fitting together and what the logical the logic behind these connections might be. Let's say one last one, pronouns. Pronouns would be words like he, she, it, you, I, we, you all, they. Now, sometimes it's not clear what it is a pronoun is referring to, and that's where it's especially important for us to try to identify what's going on with the pronoun, especially its antecedent, and that's kind of another English grammar word to talk about. What is it that the pronoun is referring back to? For example, with 1 John, this is an issue right there at the beginning of the book, because 1 John starts out right there in the beginning talking about we have seen and beheld and touched and handled the word of truth. Well, who's the we? You know, we have touched, we have seen, we have handled. Who is the we? Well, it doesn't say there at the beginning that it was, you know, Bill and Harry and I. There's no we there. And so that's an important pronoun to try to identify the antecedent. Now, the antecedent's not actually given to us there in the text. But it is an important antecedent to try to identify because it shapes our interpretation of the book as a whole. It has something to do with, you know, who the authors are. And given the fact that the we there talks about their firsthand encounters with Jesus, is probably referring to the apostles or John and his close associates who've had a firsthand encounter with the earthly Jesus. But there will be an example of... Now, what I will do is... I'll just draw an arrow from the he back to whatever the he is referring to. If it's referring back to John, I'll just draw an arrow from he back to John and say that's what the antecedent is. All right, I'm going to leave it there. I think that gives us enough to work with at the outset. And what I'd like you to do is just take... Again, we're not going to have 3 days like the student did with the story, but I'd like to give you a few minutes... maybe 5 minutes or so, to try to make some of these observations that we've listed here. See if you can find some repeating words, you know, maybe mark them with some of the different colors that you have there with your crayons. I raided my boys' crayon supply. I usually use colored pencils or something, but I didn't have enough colored pencils to go around, so we got crayons today. See if you see the word but anywhere and mark that. See if you see the words as or like, or any list, or cause and effect, or any figures.
The he back to whatever the he is referring to. If it's referring back to John, I'll just draw an arrow from he back to John and say that's what the antecedent is. All right, I'm going to leave it there. I think that gives us enough to work with at the outset. And what I'd like you to do is just take... Again, we're not going to have 3 days like the student did with the story, but I'd like to give you a few minutes, maybe 5 minutes or so, to try to make some of these observations that we've listed here. See if you can find some repeating words, you know, maybe mark them with some of the different colors that you have there with your crayons. I raided my boys' crayon supply. I usually use colored pencils or something, but I didn't have enough colored pencils to go around, so we got crayons today. See if you see the word but anywhere and mark that. See if you see the words as or like, or any list, or cause and effect, or any figures of speech, or conjunctions, or pronouns. What are their antecedents? Work with that for 5 minutes or so here, and then
We'll try to pool our insights and see if we can learn from one another and get a more full picture by pulling all of our thoughts together here in a few minutes. All right, I know you'd like to have more time to work on that, but let's just share some of our thoughts together, and we can try to pull some things together on the overhead. How about repeating words? Were there any repeating words that you saw there? Charles, what did you see? Is it Charles? Is that right?
That's Jeff. Yeah. Charles.
Yeah. Is it Jeff?
I'm Charles.
Hi, Charles. Jeff, is it Jeff?
No, it's
Charles.
Charles. I go by Chuck.
Chuck, okay.
wicked.
Okay, where did you see wicked?
It's in the first verse.
Okay, I'm gonna take my red marker, and I'm gonna put a red circle around wicked in verse 1. Okay.
Verse 4,
the wicked are not so. Okay.
Verse 5, therefore the wicked will not stand.
Wicked will not stand. Okay.
And the last verse 6,
the way of the wicked will perish. Okay. Any other thoughts about repeating words?
Nor.
I heard that over here as well. Who walks not. I'm just going to put a little symbol like that there. Nor stands in the way of sinners. Nor sits in the seat of scoffers. Leaf does not wither. The wicked are not so. The wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. Now, I did there lump nor and not together. I don't usually do that with the same word. Some of you might have had questions about sinners there, wicked and sinners, because that's the same kind of...
Sinners is in there a couple times.
Yeah, sinners appears here as well as down in verse 5, right? So, again, I would probably save the symbol of a red circle just for the word wicked alone. But what I might do here is use the same color and say put a red rectangle around sinners there in verse 1 as well as down in verse 5. And that way I can see that the word sinners is used twice with the red rectangle, but I can also use that as a way of reminding myself that sinners and wicked are similar conceptually. In fact, I might even want to, put a red cloud, same color cloud around scoffers, and I see all those words have to do with, wicked people. Now, if I were to try to interpret Psalm 1 and I never made mention of the wicked, then I would have been missing something here, right? Okay. What other repeating words? You see any other repeating words here?
He.
Okay. And usually pronouns I wouldn't mark as a even though it is a repeating word. If I start marking every instance of he, it might clutter up my paper a bit. Now, one of the things we might want to do with he, though, is figure out who the he is. Like in verse 3, Bob, what, do you have a thought about who does the he refer to? He is like a tree. Who is this he?
The blessed.
The man.
Yeah, the blessed, this man up here in verse 1, who doesn't walk in the counsel of the wicked or stand in the way of sinners or sit in the seat of scoffers. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water. Were there any other antecedents that you wanted to make note of?
It is the same. All those he's and his.
Yeah. How about this one right here? On his law, he meditates. Is that
right?
Yeah, I was throwing you a curveball there, Chuck.
Yes. I was looking at verse 2.
Okay, verse 2. His delight is in the law of the Lord. Yes, the blessed man's delight is in the law of the Lord. In all that he does. He prospers. This refers to the blessed man. What is this one? This his law in verse 2. Yeah, the law of the Lord and on his law. That refers back to the Lord. Okay, so there's a little practice with antecedents. How about contrast? Did you see any contrast in the book. Becky, did you see any contrast? Okay, day and night. That would be a contrast. Now there, we're not using the word but that's a good example of times where you might have a contrast that you don't have the word. But so over in the margin, I would do something like this, right? Day and then night is being contrasted there. It's not bringing out so much of a contrast, really, as it is using these two contrasting times to say that he meditates all the time. It's sort of like us saying he does this from A to Z or something like that. It's the technical word for it is a merism. But did you have another observation there, Becky? I did.
Righteous.
Now that's a contrast that's really happening kind of over the whole psalm. That's really sort of a comprehensive contrast. Did anybody see the words but? Does the word but appear anywhere in the Bible? Where do you see but? Verse 2, but his delight.
Verse 6, the way of the wicked will perish.
Yes. Yes. So verse 2, but his delight. Verse 4, the wicked are not so, but are like chaff. And then verse 6, the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Now, one of the things that we should do is not just identify that there is a contrast because we've seen the word but try to analyze that a little bit and try to see, okay, we see that there is a contrast because the but identifies there's a contrast, but what is the nature of the contrast? What is it, for example, in that's being contrasted by the but in verse 2? Does anybody have a thought about that?
Say the question one more
time. This but that begins verse 2, what is it contrasting?
The delight of
the righteous
versus the wicked.
What's your name again?
Levon Obisher.
Levon, okay. Levon said it's contrasting what the blessed man takes delight in versus what the wicked man takes delight in. There's something going on there. I don't know. Does it say what the delight of the wicked man is in verse 1? It doesn't really say that, so maybe that's not, maybe we haven't quite got to it yet.
It's verse 4.
You want to come down here? Oh, we were talking about this bud in verse 2.
But it comes down to that one.
Okay. All right. What are your thoughts there, Chuck?
Well, that's where the wicked, you know, they're like chaff which dwindles away. So both those parts almost kind of go to the same place there.
Yeah, I haven't said it yet. You haven't said what is it contrasting?
The righteous, you know, being like a tree planted by a stream of water, you know, just fruit and all that stuff.
Okay.
The wicked man is like the law.
Okay, yeah, and that's, I think, maybe there's a contrast that's going on all the way through the psalm between the wicked person and the blessed man or the righteous man. We'll get down here to this one. Yeah, I think you're right in terms of the contrast in verse 4. The contrast is between this man being planted like a tree and then the chaff so the righteous man is like a tree, the wicked man is like chaff. I think there is a contrast that's going on there, highlighted by the but. What about this but in verse 2? Yes.
To me, it looks like while the wicked man is busy getting the counsel of the wicked and standing in the way of the sinners and sitting with scoffers, the righteous are taking the time to delight in the law of the Lord.
Yeah, I think that's moving in the right direction. This word about the counsel of the wicked, for example, what is this saying when it says a man doesn't walk in the counsel of the wicked? It's saying that he doesn't listen to ungodly people and say, oh yeah, I think that's right, you know, I think you've got a really great idea about what we should do there, what's right and wrong. He's not getting his advice and input and taking his cue on what ungodly people around him think or say. He's taking his cue from the law of the Lord. He's taking his cue on the revealed will of God, what God has revealed about his desires in his word. And so I think the contrast there is ultimately about one's authority. You know, where do you take your direction? And where do you get your guidance for how to live life from? Do you take it from the world and the wicked, or you take it from what God has revealed in his word? So we could talk about these other contrasts as well, but let's press on. How about comparisons? Did you see any comparisons there?
Man, like a tree.
Okay, like a tree, yes. So I'm gonna put an orange circle around like. Now, when we have the word like or as, remember we want to think about what the topic is, what the illustration is, and then what the point of similarity is. What's being talked about here? What's the topic in this?
His roots are planted deep.
Okay, that might be more the point of similarity or something like that, but what's being talked about here? Yeah, the he, okay? The he is being talked about, and the he refers to, we already said, back to the man in verse 1. Now, the he is being illustrated by means of what illustration? The tree, yeah. Yeah, and you're right. It's not just the tree, but it's a certain kind of tree. The tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in season and its leaf does not wither. That kind of tree. That's the kind of tree that the blessed man is like. So we've identified the topic, the he. We've identified the illustration, the tree. Tree planted like streams of water that yields its fruit in season and its leaf does not wither. Then the question is, what's the point of similarity? How is it that this man is like this tree? Anybody have any thoughts about that? The point of similarity? How is this blessed man like that kind of a tree? Yields fruit, and we're kind of interpreting a metaphor by means of another metaphor of yielding fruit. But can we make that into a non
metaphor?
Okay.
He's kind of like an evergreen. He stays.
Okay.
That's the way he is. That's the way he will be.
Okay. So
he's not engaged in a thing that has the power to destroy.
Not engaged in things that have the power to destroy. Okay.
Never thirsty.
Never thirsty. Okay. Okay. Yeah. It's a good tree, right? I mean, okay, it's growing, it's productive.
He's deeply rooted.
Okay, he's deeply rooted. I think that is an important thing.
Productive and nourished. So it's what he's not engaging in allow him to be fruitful.
Okay.
To be strong.
Now, one of the things we've got a lot of suggestions here. I think this one's a good one because it fits in with the context when he talks about being nourished, and some of the other things you said fit in the context, some better than others. When we start talking about this tree, we could come up with a lot of potential points of similarity, but we have to listen to the text and see if there's a particular point of similarity that the text is moving to. And the idea of the tree being nourished by the waters, that might fit in well with this man meditating on the law and being nourished by the law in that sense. I think also the idea of the rootedness, weren't you the one who said rootedness, Bob?
The living water.
Yes, that would be maybe another symbol of the law nourishing this man as he meditates. How about this other one that we mentioned earlier, the wicked are like chaff, if we circle that like, what is the topic that we're talking about here? The wicked. So I'm going to draw an arrow over to the wicked, and then what is the wicked being compared to?
Chaff.
Now, what we might have to say, what in the world is chaff? We might have to get our dictionaries out or do some historical cultural background in order to say what chaff is. Any farmers here? We don't have as much of an agrarian society as the ancient Hebrew culture was, but anybody? Yes. You know, anybody want to give a definition of chaff? Or
during the wheat.
Yes. Yeah, there's a thin kind of protective layer over the grain. It's a very light kind of flaky thing. You don't eat it. It's not worth anything. And so what you would do in the ancient world, in fact, you still see this same kind of thing various parts of the world that don't have industrialized technology, agricultural technology. But you might go up to the top of a hill or something where the wind is blowing and take a pitchfork or something like that and throw the grain up in the air, and the chaff, this light, very light stuff, just floats away in the wind. And so the question is, how is the wicked person, if this is the topic and this is the illustration, how is the wicked person like chaff? What's the point of similarity? Does he have dandruff or flaky skin or
no,
okay. What? What's the point of similarity?
He's like the chaff, he just blows in the wind. He's got no roots, he's got nothing.
Okay, that's an interesting thing that you're saying about the rootedness, because you know, we've got these two agricultural metaphors here, the tree planted and the chaff that gets blown away in the wind. And so there does seem to be something with that point of similarity that fits the context here. This is a rooted person versus an unrooted person, a person without roots.
That would be a believer and a non-believer.
Yes, yes.
There's something here about the grain in the agricultural field. Is there something about chaff being an undeveloped, it's in an undeveloped state, that's a peas. Is something that does not develop?
I don't think that would be the case for chaff. The chaff is just a different part of the plant. So it doesn't matter how long you wait, it's not going to become something else. It just serves a different purpose.
Yeah, a byproduct. Could you call that a byproduct of wheat?
Yeah, it's a byproduct of wheat that it has a function early on, but this is not talking about the good function earlier on. This is talking about when you've got no purpose for it, there's no use for it anymore. Now, one of the last things here on our list, we talked about marking conjunctions. And let me just mark this one right here at the beginning. Here's therefore, that's a conjunction. This one down at the end, for, is another conjunction. We might have some others there. So the words that begin both verse 5 and 6 are conjunctions. We might think about, you know, the therefore, and someone has said, you know, when you see a therefore, ask what the therefore is there for. Let me ask you this. If you were to divide this passage out into subunits, if you were to break this passage into pieces, do you see any natural pieces that it would fall into? If this were a navel orange, and you were trying to peel apart the navel orange, where would the pieces be? We don't want to get our butcher knife out. We want to see the natural divisions in the text. Okay, yeah, I think that's right. Between verses 3 and 4, why do you say that, Becky? I agree with that, but why do you say that? Yeah, right.
Well, 4 through 6 is
about the wicked. Okay. Yes, I agree with you that verses 1 through 3, he mentions the wicked and sinners and scoffers, but his focus is on, he only mentions them as a way of talking about the righteous person. So verses 1 through 3 are focused on the righteous person, how he lives, what he allows to govern his life. He doesn't allow the world around him to govern his life. He governs his life based on what God has revealed in his word. And as a result, in fact, that's a cause and effect, isn't it? The cause of of him delighting in the law of the Lord and governing his life around what God has revealed leads to this effect of him being like a tree planted by streams of water, being a prosperous, productive, rooted person. Now, how about, would the rest of you agree that 4 through 6 all go together? Well, the problem with... what's that? Except for 6? Yeah, I think except for 6 is right, because he mentions the way of the righteous and contrasts that with the way of the wicked. So verse 6 almost seems like it's sort of a summarizing statement or something. So you've got verses 1 through 3 that talk about the righteous person, verses 4 and 5 that talk about the wicked person, and verse 6 is a summary statement. Now notice that therefore there. Within verses 4 and 5, you... I just want to make the note that this idea that Bob brought up about the rootedness seems to flow through here, because notice what it says. The wicked are like chaff. How are they like chaff? The wind drives them away. They're not, when the wind comes along, you might think of this tree here. It's planted, it's rooted, it's stable, it's secure. The wind comes along here and the chaff blows it away. Well, what's the bigger metaphor? Well, it goes on to say, therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment. In other words, the picture seems to be when God's judgment falls, just like chaff is blown away in the wind, the wicked are blown away in God's judgment. But the righteous, he knows their way in the sense that he's in relationship with them and so forth. Now, we've seen a lot of things there. I tell you, we have not seen everything that's in this text. We've just begun to see some of the things that are here. There's more things here that we haven't yet seen, but I wanted to encourage you in this way, because you know, you guys spent 5 minutes or so looking for observations. We spent another 20 minutes or so trying to share some of our observations and get them all onto one page. But I hope that you can see how this process of making observations, it helps us to see what's there. It helps us to appropriate the meaning of the text for ourselves without having to, you know, turn to some secondary resource. This gets it into us and helps us to more deeply appropriate it than we would otherwise. And so I hope you'll maybe take this method back to your churches and so forth.